Welcome back to Talking About California. This morning, we begin a new series of programs about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. We begin this morning on a very sad note. In July, this past summer, Alexander Coburn, the renowned radical journalist, died the victim of a long, fierce battle with cancer. He was 71 years old. We will remember Alexander as our neighbor. He resided up the coast in Petrolia, California, in southern Humboldt County. He was a frequent visitor to Mendocino County, most recently to speak 3 years running for our coastal group, Parents for Peace. He spoke here most recently on war and peace, on the rise of the Tea Party, and on the crisis of Obama's presidency. He was for years a contributor to the Anderson Valley Advertiser. I first met Alexander in the 60s in London, where he was already an established writer, having co-authored with Robin Blackburn a collection on trade unionism. We met again here in the year 2000. He was a generous and gracious supporter of our anti-war efforts, making the three-hour drive here on his own time, coming only on the promise of expenses from whatever we could raise in the collection plate. I was always quite honored to find one of my own compositions included in Counterpunch. The newsletter offered readers a dazzling array of contributors, all in international perspective. It's an extraordinary journal, edited with his longtime friend and collaborator, Jeffrey St. Clair, and we'll turn to that. But first, let me introduce this morning's guest, Jeffrey St. Clair, co-editor of Counterpunch, himself an author or editor of some 15 books. Here's a taste: Red State Rebels, Born Under a Bad Sky, Grand Theft Pentagon, High Water Every Place, New Orleans, and the Shame of America. Jeffrey was born in the Middle West. He was educated at the American University. He's been an environmentalist since his youth, having worked for Friends of the Earth and Clean Water Action. In 1990, he moved to Oregon, where he lives now. In 1994, he joined Alexander on Counterpunch. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning, Cal.
And thanks very much for joining us this morning. I wonder if I could just first, for our listeners' sake, ask you a bit more about yourself. How did you come to find your way to Counterpunch, and then perhaps a word about Alexander to begin with?
Well, I was, I guess we go back to 92. Bill Clinton had just been elected president. He was in the middle of the transition period. I was editing a radical environmental journal called Wild Forest Review in Portland at the time. And I got a call in the office, and it went something like this: Jeffrey, this is Alexander Coburn at The Nation calling. I took a breath, a deep one. I'd been reading Alex's writing, you know, since the 70s. I went to school in D.C., and the Village Voice was required reading. And I went to Coburn and Ridgway's Press Clips column first. So I knew Alex from The Voice. The Nation, I was less interested in. I thought The Nation, you know, suffered from an East Coast bias. I thought their politics were squeamish and much of their prose tedious. So I hadn't been reading Alex in The Nation. I had no idea that he was in California at the time. So he wasn't really at The Nation when he was calling. He was in Petrolia on the Lost Coast. But he said, I read this piece that you wrote in Wild Forest Review, about Clinton's sorry environmental record in Arkansas. Now, Jeffrey, I think that you and I are perhaps the only two people to the left of David Broder that sees Clinton for the corporate whore that he is. and that sort of inaugurated a relationship between the two of us. And so we talked for about an hour, and our conversation, as it often did, was was sort of transcribed and Coburnized into a column in The Nation, which was faxed to me by the Nation fact checkers about 2 hours later, which shows Alex's, you know, dazzling speed at his Underwood, leaving skid marks on his desk. And then Alex actually started writing for me before I started joined Counterpunch, and he would contribute a monthly column to Wild Forest Review, and it's very vivid in my mind. The first issue, which featured Coburn, you know, I sent down, you know, 5 or 6 copies to Petrolia, and about a week later, I get a call, and it's Alex again. Jeffrey, just looking at this latest issue of Wild Forest Review, and it does just look glorious. Many, many interesting stories. The photographs are fantastic. I love the placement of my column, but didn't you forget something? And my heart dropped a little bit. and I said, oh, well, I don't think so. What did I forget? You know, thinking I'd mangled, you know, one of his sentences. And he said, well, what about the paycheck? I am a professional writer. And, you know, I didn't notice any of the Queen's coinage in the packet. Is my check coming? And at that time, Cal, we didn't have enough money to, you know, to pay the rent. So I said, well, would you accept a bottle of scotch as payment for your column? He goes, scotch. I don't drink scotch. Make it Irish whiskey, Jameson's. So every month I would ship a bottle of Jameson's from Oregon City down to Petrolia as payment for Alex's column. And
well, that's fair. That's very good. I wonder if we could just continue on that for a minute, because in my own memories of Alexander, you know, beginning back in the days of the New Left in London, I think of a rather sort of Marxist movement and you know, Marxist intellectuals arguing about international capitalism and so forth. And yet it's interesting that Alexander was a deep environmentalist as well. Where did that come from?
Well, I think he was born with that, actually. I mean, Alex he loved open country, wild country. He's a devoted animal lover. He was born with that, and that never changed. I think he was also, you know, born a communist too, certainly, you know, under the influence of his father, Claude Coburn. But I think ultimately, you know, Alex was not a sort of doctrinaire Marxist-Leninist. People ask me, I've, you know, done many, many interviews. I think the first question out of the obituary writer at the Washington Post was, you know, well, you know, wasn't Alex a communist? And I said, well, I don't know how he ended up. He used to refer to himself as an anarcho-syndicalist, but I think he just liked how many syllables that had to it. He was kind of a left libertarian at the end, but the thing is, Alex was really interested in people and in talking to people. Was one of the reasons he could have a conversation with an academic Marxist, and, you know, and that a few hours later in the afternoon you could see him in an animated discussion, you know, with the guy who's running the sausage shop or a gun nut. It's just Alex was really interested in people, and I think he became much less sectarian. You know, in the time that I knew him, he didn't seem to be sectarian at all.
Implying that he was at one time.
Well, I think he was. I mean, if you go back and you read the early books, I'm thinking of, you mentioned the one on trade unionists. I remember the one that he wrote with Robin Blackburn called Student Power.
All
I don't
right.
know if you remember that.
Sure.
Which I think may have come out...
71, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Which was much, you know, I think it did, you know, stick within the confines of what was we then called the New Left, which seems kind of creaky these days. But And I think that Alex's relationship with the New Left Review, I mean, he was, you know, always, you know, always quitting the board, and he would be gone for, 6 or 7 months, irritated by something Mike Davis had written. and then he would be slowly seduced back onto the board.
Petrolia is and environmentalism. What could you say about that connection?
Well, it's interesting that Alex ended up in Petrolia, which is it's just a remarkable place. It probably has, you've been there. It probably has the highest per capita IQ of any place in the country, wouldn't you think? I mean, a lot of the people down there, you have former professors at Berkeley and Stanford who were either denied tenure for their anti-war activism or, you know, got fed up with the administrations during the late 60s and early 70s and went back to, kind of establish their own community in this very isolated, beautiful valley with salmon and steelhead running up the Mattole, old growth redwoods and Douglas firs. You really could. It was back to the land movement in the best sense. You know, founding your own libraries, your own schools, your own community without police or sheriffs. It's a wonderful and long-running experiment in sort of community building.
I suppose
Alex had, as you know from the title of one of his books, The Golden Age Is In Us, Alex was a utopian, and he was looking for these, little utopias. I think not in any kind of ultra-romantic sense. I mean, his favorite quote from Lenin, which became, I'm talking about Vlad, which became the motto at Counterpunch, was to be as radical as reality. And I think that you find that down in Petrolia.
Well, it seemed to me, unfortunately, in the circumstances, quite interesting to think about the impact he seemed to have on the community there in Petrolia, and particularly on the young people who were around that day. Would you say that was a correct observation?
Well, he had a huge impact on the youth of the valley, and I think that it is hard to grow up particularly as a teenager in such an isolated place. But Alex provided, he employed half the kids in the valley. They were, working on Rancho Coburn, doing gardening, working in his beautiful orchard, or doing art projects for them. And he was having, performances, at his place. There would be little plays, there would be music. It was a very sort of festive and welcoming and creative, 10 to 15 acres there at Rancho Coburn. And he liked young people, and they admired him.
So back to Counterpunch. You stopped short of when and how you joined Counterpunch, and how you and then maybe Alexander, how you saw the what would we call it, an online journal or online?
Yeah, I think the evolution of Counterpunch is interesting. It was actually started by one of Alex's former interns at The Nation, Ken Silverstein, in 1992. And Ken is one of our most gifted investigative reporters. After leaving The Nation, Ken went to Brazil for 2 years. I think he was an AP stringer down there, wrote the first book on Lula, and covered that Lula's worker movement in Brazil, and then moved back to D.C., and started Counterpunch, which in its initial incarnation was really focused on D.C. politics and influence peddling. a lot of stories on lobbyists and political action committees and the influence of the corrupting influence of money on politics. After about maybe 6 months of doing this, Counterpunch came out. It was at that time, I think, 6 pages, which would be about 3, you know, good investigative stories twice a month. And after about 6 months of doing that, Ken just said, I can't do this on my own. So he invited Alex to come on board as co-editor. And, I think about maybe 6 months later, they decided that the two of them couldn't keep it up on their own, so they invited me to come aboard as an investigative reporter for them. And I covered defense issues, the environment, and some of the early Clinton scandals. And that was great. You really had, you know, two weeks to work on your story, and you could really sink your teeth into it. Then, I guess it was maybe 96 or 97, Ken wrote a fantastic story in Harper's called The Radioactive Boy Scout, which some of you may remember, about a 17-year-old kid in Chicago who essentially puts together a nuclear weapon without the fissionable material in his parents' garage. And Ken wrote a great story for Harper's about it, and that was immediately seized upon by book agents and movie agents, and so he got a big deal, a big book contract and movie contract for that story, and he left used that as the ticket out of Counterpunch onto bigger and better things, so at that point I became co-editor of Counterpunch, and really the focus kind of shifted. I mean, Alex and I were both on the West Coast, and so we started writing, taking a broader view of the world, I think, and less about D.C.-oriented politics and more about social movements across the U.S. and ultimately across the world. I think we do have a very sort of international presence, a lot of international writers. And then we're both Luddites, Cal. So we came to the web sort of kicking and screaming at each other. And we didn't even reserve our own website. It was a very sort of prescient, forward-thinking Counterpunch subscriber said, realize that if you don't reserve your web domain, somebody else is going to take it hostage. And so they did that for us and sort of lured us onto the web. And the question in our mind was, look, we, work very hard on our print issue, and if we just throw stuff up on the website, which is a nice commons, but, how are we going to be able to support ourselves as professional writers in doing that? So we didn't really use the web very much until, 99 and 2000 with Clinton's war on Serbia, and which we covered. Maybe we had new stuff up there once every 2 or 3 days. And then after that war fizzled out, we went back to, the site basically went back into hibernation. And it wasn't until, Alex called me at whatever it was, 5 o'clock in the morning on September 11, 2001, and said, get up and turn your television on. And we saw the second plane hit the second tower, and we decided, well, we better get something up on the website now. And from that day since, Cal, our lives really changed, because Counterpunch became online became a daily newspaper, and we were publishing. Well, we do 10 stories a day, and almost from the very beginning did that. So 10 stories every day, and then we do a weekend edition, which usually has 30 stories, and it is basically consumed. it consumed both of our lives, and.
Alexander, last time he was down here, was explaining to a group in Fort Bragg a little bit about Counterpunch, and he offered an extraordinary account of the number of hits the newsletter gets. Do you remember what he would have said?
At one point, the high point for us, and, you know, I mean, every time a war comes along, Cal, it's good business for us. But the high point for us was really during the Israeli, the latest Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which took place during also the height of the Bush administration and the kind of political panic on the left about Bush. And we were getting, there are different ways of calculating it, but 150,000 unique visitors a day, which translated to, you know, 1.5 million page views and, you know, like 3 million hits a day. So those were big numbers. At that time, we were getting more traffic to Counterpunch than the Washington Post was getting on a daily basis, and the LA Times. They really hadn't figured out the web at that point. Now, since then, there's a lot more competition out there, and you know, our numbers have declined a little bit, but we're holding our own for, you know, a two-man operation, essentially, you know, competing with the big boys. And we have what a lot of them don't have, which is a global audience. We have almost as many readers in India as we do from Canada or Great Britain. A lot of daily readers in South Africa, and you know, in Middle Eastern countries where our site isn't banned. I think the Iranians sort of take us down and put us up on a weekly basis.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program is Talking About California. Today we're talking to the editor of Counterpunch, Jeffrey St. Clair, and we're talking about his partner at Counterpunch, Alexander Coburn, who tragically died this past summer. Jeff, sticking with Counterpunch a minute or two longer. I, listening to you talk about Alexander as utopian and you two as Luddites and the newsletter as a commons. That's kind of interesting language, which you know, goes back probably to at least for Alexander to his origins in the British Isles, and I wonder how you came to use that language and how you see it reflected in both your environmental coverage and your political coverage at Counterpunch.
Probably it may go back to our mutual love of the Romantic poets, particularly Byron and Shelley, who were Luddites, utopians, revolutionaries. Both Alex and I were English lit majors. I don't know how we ended up in politics, both of us. But so we shared that, and I think also a love of the French Revolution and the revolutionaries. The more radical, the better. I remember Alex and I did an interview with a historian one time who said, "There's only one revolution, the French Revolution." And that didn't go far enough. So, I mean, it's something that, you know, that we shared. A love of nature, a love of poetry, a love of utopian revolutionaries. And, I think... Maybe it's also a kind of, I don't know if you will find that kind of confluence anymore coming out of the universities. I think I graduated in 1980, I think, 80 or 81. And it was right at the point where critical theory was beginning to totally infect the English literature departments. My professors were mostly new critics, so focused on the text and not on textual criticism. My feeling now in going back to campuses is that the critical theorists dominate, and you're not reading, you know, Byron and Shelley and Coleridge as much anymore as their interpreters.
And what about Luddites? The two of you as Luddites. Again, it's a very interesting. It's an old phenomenon, but it crops up routinely. The idea of Luddism. How would you explain it?
Well, I mean, if we can see it in Alex and his devotion to his Underwood typewriter, Cal, which he persisted in clinging to, even. Let's see, when did we finally seduce him to getting his first iBook? I think that must have been very close to the year 2000. I think it's a suspicion of technology, the fact that the technocrats want an automated world that is alienating to workers, that is alienating us from nature, from community. You know, at a theoretical level, those are the things that sort of how Alex interpreted it. And at a basic level, I think that you know, he loved old cars. I'm not sure that, you know, that's Luddism, but certainly he did not want to use a car that had a catalytic converter on it. You would never find him, you know, tootling around in one of those. You know, he liked his old early 60s Valiant, his 1959 Imperial, which is about a block long, I think, the first time it pulled up in Oregon City. You know, it took up about half of our block.
And Counterpunch as a Commons, one last go.
Well, Counterpunch as a Commons. I think, you know, it's both a commons in terms of the fact that it's free to read online, the fact that it brings in a virtual community of people all over the world, and also the fact that our writers, yeah, we have some high-profile writers. We also like running new writers. We like running young writers. We like running, you know, writers from across the world, whether it's India or Syria or Tunisia, Australia, New Zealand, and I think that I think it's one of the things that keeps Counterpunch fresh and exciting is we have a really interesting mix of established and new voices on the site.
Well, maybe now we could turn, for our listeners' sake, who perhaps don't know the whole story of Alexander, would you mind giving us a little bit of a biographical picture of Alexander Coburn, where he came from? Maybe our listeners might want to know a bit about his very interesting family.
Well, the Coburns go way back in Scottish history. I think many lords, many barristers. I think it's basically a family of lawyers till it became a family of journalists. But if you read, Alex liked to write about his family in a kind of anecdotal way. So there would be stories about Lord Coburn, who was you know, the governor of India, or Lord Coburn, the chief prosecutor of England, or his great 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 uncle. I think it was Lieutenant George Coburn, who burned the White House during the War of 1812.
Right.
So it's a very established family going way back in English and Scottish history. His father, Claude Coburn, was one of the premier radical journalists of the 20th century, incredibly productive. He covered the war in Spain, edited a counterpunch-like journal called The Week, which was read by FDR, Winston Churchill, and Stalin. It got him on many, many lists as a provocateur, as a communist. I think the FBI had a file on Claude Coburn, and they considered him one of the 250 most dangerous communists in the world. And at the same time he was on that list, he was also, you know, writing novels, which were made into Hollywood pictures, the most famous of which is probably Beat the Devil, which a great novel, also a fantastic film directed by John Huston and starring Humphrey Bogart. And Claude, you know, like Alex, Claude could write about anything. He once interviewed Al Capone. He would write literary criticism. He would write about architecture. He would write about gardening. He would write about, do little travel pieces on Ireland, where he lived, I think during the last half of his life, primarily in Ireland. Alex was born in 1941 in Scotland, and he was born in Scotland because at the time London was being bombed by V1 and V2 rockets, I think. So his mother, Patricia, had been evacuated to Scotland, and so Alex was born there and spent his early years there, which he describes as being very cold and wet and kind of bleak. I think he much preferred Ireland to Scotland. Alex was a brilliant student and went to Oxford, where he read, as I said, English literature. Went to work. I think his first real job as a journalist was working for the Times Literary Supplement, a very prestigious job, and he was reviewing books. I think one of the first book reviews he did, which you can find online at the New Left Review, if you go to that site, was a very funny review of Joseph Heller's Catch-22. And so Alex was at the in at the ground floor of the New Left Review and the New Left movement with his colleagues Perry Anderson and Robin Blackburn in particular. And then in, I believe, 72, he was recruited by Jim Ridgway, who at that time was publishing a radical investigative newsletter in Washington, D.C. called Hard Times. And he was recruited to be Hard Times European correspondent, and then was asked to come to the U.S. and write for Hard Times in New York. And this was an incredible collection of journalists, Cal. You had Ridgway, you had Andy Copkind, and you had Robert Sherrill and Alex. Sherrill went on to be one of the most gifted writers about the politics of oil, and was, I think, the Texas Weekly that he started. Andy Copkind, of course, went on to become the managing editor, I think, of The Nation magazine. And Alex and Ridgway went on to The Village Voice with their very influential press clips.
And the family, a word about his extended family.
Well, he has two. Alex has two brothers. There is Andrew Coburn, who is a incredibly talented documentary filmmaker, as well as being a journalist. He wrote a fantastic book on just a scorching biography of Donald Rumsfeld. He started out, I believe, as a defense reporter, breaking a lot of the contractor scandals back in the late 70s and early 80s. Wrote a very prescient book about the sort of hollow Soviet military buildup called The Threat, which depicted the Soviet military as a kind of Potemkin military. Very influential book. His youngest brother, Patrick, is probably the most gifted war reporter of our time. He writes for The Independent in England as well as Counterpunch. 2 years ago, he won the Gellhorn Prize for war reporting. And then he has his niece, Laura Flanders, is had a radio show. She's also writes for Counterpunch. She's written a couple books. She started out writing for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the left-wing sort of media critic group. And her sister, Stephanie Flanders, was the speechwriter for Larry Summers, the notorious Larry Summers, and is now, I think, the chief economics correspondent for the BBC. So
yeah, very, very interesting, a little humbling to think about this inheritance that these this family seems to have come by. The of the many reasons to read Counterpunch, I would suggest to people who haven't yet or who possibly don't that Patrick Coburn's writings alone are worth checking in, you know, every day to see what's there.
What people probably don't know about Patrick is that he had a severe case of polio as a child. Alex also had polio, but it was a milder case, so you really wouldn't know it. But Patrick, his left leg is almost non-functional. So now he is a real war reporter, Cal. He was in Iraq, not embedded, but out in the field in Iraq for, you know, both wars.
Some of our listeners may, you know, memory is short, may have forgotten already, but just as a journalist, you know this. Say a word about this whole development of the embedded reporter and how Patrick stood out against that.
Well, essentially, if you wanted to report on as a U.S. reporter, you were almost required to be credentialed by the U.S. military to essentially go where they told you, to sort of clear your stories through them. It was essentially a kind of censorship. And, you know, it wasn't just censorship. It was designed to allow the reporters to build a camaraderie with U.S. troops and generals. So, you know, it was both censorship and then operating at a subtler level. Your movement was restricted. You know, what you could report on was restricted. Became very, very biased. That's not the way Patrick operated. Patrick was out in villages in Iraq that were on the receiving end of shock and awe.
And he did this constrained by the fact that he walked with the assistance of.
He walked with a cane. He's tall, pale skinned, and yes, And so he is in the middle of the war zone and walking with a cane and sometimes crutches and reporting from those zones. And the reporting was just brilliant. It just made you feel like you were there.
And still is.
Yeah, it still is. Yes, it is. I mean, he was in Libya. He was in Tunisia. He's been to Syria. In fact, when Alex took a turn for the worse as he was undergoing his final cancer treatments in Germany, Patrick had just gone covertly into Syria. And we had to get a hold of him and let him know that Alex probably had only a few days to live, and he had to get himself out of a very hairy situation in Syria and to Germany. I mean, it was just—he's just an amazing reporter, amazing life.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm the host of Talking About California. Today's guest is Counterpunch editor Jeffrey St. Clair, and we're talking about his longtime friend and co-editor, Alexander Coburn, who died, sadly, just this last summer. Alexander could be known as kind of a hard man, and I think there were people who thought of him that way, possibly didn't like him so much. We never found him to be like that when he'd come down to Mendocino for our Parents for Peace events, and we always noticed his very generous interest in young people in particular. I remember one morning he spent I think an hour talking with our daughter Rosie about what her plans were for college and the future and so forth. But he did have his conflicts about ideas, sometimes conflicts with other people. I wonder if you could just pick out one that you think might be important and explain how you understood it.
Well, are you referring covertly here to?
Oh, I don't know.
To his conflict with
Jeffrey, you could. No, it doesn't.
You're drawing me in.
No.
I think there were environmental
issues. There were issues about child care. My thought is that here was a person who, it's said in the masthead of Counterpunch, here was a person who could sometime take the unpopular position, even with his friends and comrades.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that Alex. If you wanted to, you know, to be friends with Alex, you really had to be willing to argue with him. I mean, because every position he wanted to see, you know, proved and stood up to a kind of logical test. I enjoyed it. We didn't agree on a lot of things, Cal. Give us an
example.
Well, I mean, global warming is the obvious one, and that was a 15-year running dispute between the two of us, and it was fun. Others wanted to put him on trial for being a global warming denialist, but you know, I knew that regardless of what Alex said about global warming, that his enemies were the oil companies, the coal companies, and unlike some of the proponents of global warming theory, the nuclear power industry. So that was fun. For me, it was fun. But I think at a more serious level, you know, he and Christopher Hitchens were friends for many years. I think Christopher named one of his children after Alex. But when Christopher, you know, went off the deep end and became essentially a neoconservative, began, giving lectures to the people in the Bush White House, when he betrayed his friend Sidney Blumenthal and, you know, tried to have him indicted for perjury during the Clinton scandals. You know, that was a line that Alex was not going to tolerate that. And so he called Christopher out on it. And Christopher, I think, just became, from my point of view, corrupt and kind of despicable. And the way he treated his friends, when Edward Said, very close to Christopher, obviously a very good friend of ours at Counterpunch, but he was also very close to Christopher. When Said was dying of cancer, Christopher just went after him in a vicious way. And this was Edward Said, who had done so much to elevate Christopher Hitchens as a literary figure in Manhattan. Just despicable. And he did, Christopher turned on Noam Chomsky, who had also been very close to him, and he turned on Gore Vidal, who had pronounced him his dauphin. So, you know, Alex just, I think he was going to call him on it, and it became almost something for the tabloids, I guess, the disputes between the two of them. It was fun to watch from the trenches.
Sure. And Alexander has had his ups and downs and bumps on the issue of Israel and anti-Semitism as well, although he seemed to have come through it, very well and very strongly.
Yeah, I mean, he was, if you go back to, the end of his tenure with the Village Voice, I mean, Alex was really, I think, one of the first New York writers to begin taking, writing about the Palestinians in a sympathetic way, really giving voice to their plight. And he had gotten a contract from an Arab American foundation to write a book on the Palestinians. I don't know, it was a grant for like $10,000 or something. And this was that grant was leaked to, I think, the Boston Phoenix, one of those papers up there, who made a big deal out of it, saying tainted money. And they really intimidated the Voice into suspending Alex for a few months. And at the time, he was writing a weekly column for the Wall Street Journal, I think. And it's pretty funny because when, in the midst of all of this hysteria, the editor of the Wall Street Journal was asked, well, aren't you going to suspend or fire Coburn for, taking this grant from an Arab foundation? And the editor of the journal said, over that, I mean, that's the least of what we would expect Alex to be involved in. And of course, the Wall Street Journal kept him on their editorial pages as a great voice of the left. And when the Village Voice finally, asked Alex to come back, he said, screw you, I'm not going to do it. And ended up at The Nation, thanks to Andy Kopkine.
And just sticking with this for another couple of minutes, I remember, I think it was Robin Blackburn's notes about Alexander. He called attention to Alexander's position on the lesser of two evils kind of outlook. Maybe you could say, where did that come from?
Well, I think it came from his hatred of liberal hypocrisy and liberal cant. I mean, that's what starts with that, right? But it's also an objective truth that at least since the rise of the neoliberals with Clinton, the Democratic Party has become just as beholden to corporations as the Republicans, only they're hypocritical about it, right? So they're really basically anti-entitlements, they're anti- union. We're seeing it all now. I mean, look at the response of the Democratic Party to the Chicago teachers' strike. Look at their positions on Medicare. I mean, it's really a, you know, a race between the Democrats and Paul Ryan to see who can, you know, in Medicare as we know it, right? And so we, you know, we really started pressing this issue, I think, you know, in 2000, because we had lived, you know, we had written so much and endured the multiple betrayals of Clinton and Gore, and, you know, went in whole hog for Ralph Nader. And that cost us at Counterpunch many, many donors and who blamed Gore's loss on Ralph's campaign, which was absolutely absurd, right? I mean, Gore couldn't even win his home state, right? And probably, you know, won the popular vote and the election and didn't stand up for himself. So we just doubled down on that from that point on. Ended up, you know, writing a book called Dimes Worth of Difference, Beyond the Politics of Lesser Evilism. And I think that, you know, we've been proven right. I mean, look at Obama. He's, if possible, more of a corporatist than Clinton was.
Right. Let's, we have a few minutes left, more than a few minutes. We've got about 6 or 8 minutes left. Jeffrey, I wondered if you might take a look back at the books that you and Alexander wrote together, or some of Alexander's books, and give the listener this morning an idea of where they might turn to find out more about Alexander's ideas and his experience. Are there a couple of you mentioned that the Golden Age was in us, right?
Yeah, I would. You know, if you want to read Alex, I think you start with Corruptions of Empire, which was the first in what will be a trilogy of his memoirs, and that really covers the years from the Reagan years. Essentially, there's a little bit of the Carter administration in it, but it takes you through the turbulent days of the 1980s, and then the Golden Age is in us takes you through the Bush and Clinton, the first Clinton term. And then the first book that we did together was Whiteout, the CIA, Drugs, and the Press, which is a radical history of the Central Intelligence Agency, probably engendering the most hostile review ever printed by the New York Times Book Review, which is a badge of honor for us. And
well, what didn't they like about it?
They didn't like anything about it. They didn't like you know, our exposing many of their reporters as having a relationship with the CIA, the agency they were reporting on. And you just go from there. And you know, we went in, you know, the CIA's role in assassinations and coddling drug traffickers from Central America to Laos and Vietnam, on and on and on. So, yeah, look it up online sometime. I mean, we could not do a cut and paste of the words in that review and reassemble them in any way to get a positive blurb on the paperback edition. Let's see, Alex and I's book on, I think, also our biography of Al Gore, which is one of the most vicious biographies ever written, called Al Gore, A User's Manual, is also fun. It sort of takes you through the second Clinton term, and it was a lot of fun to write. And unfortunately, we didn't get it out until about a month before the election. We were certainly hoping that Gore was going to win, so that the book would have a little bit more shelf life. but he was able to even screw that up. And we thought about putting out a paperback edition and changing the title from Al Gore, A User's Manual, to Al Gore, A Loser's Manual. But people just weren't that interested in the guy.
And as English majors, the quality of writing, it seems to me that's an issue that comes up again and again in Alexander's work and in yours. Why is it so important? One doesn't think about the internet as a place where one goes for fine literature.
Well, I wouldn't call it literature, but I think that we do like to write interesting sentences. We don't like cant. It's just, if you're going to write a sentence, you ought to think about how the sentence is structured, about the paragraph. I mean, I guess this is passé now, people are just reading tweets, and I don't know how many characters that is, 150 or something like that. Something that we struggled with was the sort of ephemeral nature of the internet. But we both like reading writers who know how to write, and many of them are right wingers. I mean, Alex is two of Alex's favorite writers, P.G. Wodehouse and Evelyn Waugh, were far to the right in terms of their politics, but some of that could be forgiven because of the quality of their prose.
And the future of Counterpunch, and what can your many readers who live here in Mendocino County, in particular, what we're talking about, what can be done to see to it that Counterpunch continues?
Well, we're plugging away, Cal. So I mean, we're trying to fire on all cylinders. I think people will see that the website is just as productive as it's ever been. I mean, there's a huge void in that we don't have Alex's diary, every Friday, and I miss that, and I'm sure our readers do too. But it's all hands on deck. Alex wouldn't have wanted it any other way. So we're pushing forward. We've just published a 32-page tribute issue to Alex, and we're putting together the next. The next issue of the print edition, which is going to be covering a big overview of the turbulence in the Middle East. We're going to be having a report on the abuse of grand juries to haul in Occupy Wall Street protesters, and a piece by Kevin Gray on the condition of Black Americans under the Obama administration. So, I mean, we have to move forward. We're going to try and do it. And we need you writing for us, and we need a lot of other people submitting stories.
Tell the listeners about the special edition of Counterpunch in honor of Alexander, and also about the, I think there may be a memorial meeting coming up in the Bay Area.
There is. So we're going to have a West Coast tribute to Alex's life and his passions, with music and film and rants from his friends. That'll be on October the 20th in San Francisco at Citizens Space, and we'll have announcements of the time and place on the website, so check in at counterpunch.org for the specifics on that memorial. And the tribute issue is hot off the press. It's 32 pages, features 26 writers, many who knew Alex intimately. It's all fresh material. We haven't recycled anything. And we have got writers like Peter Linebaugh, the great historian of the Luddites, Frank Bartike, Californian, labor historian, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, the fantastic history of the United Farm Workers Movement. We have a piece by a couple of Alex's relatives, including one of his nephews and his daughter Daisy, his close friend Pierre Spray.
Okay, I get the point, and we've got a few seconds. But what you wrote a wonderful note about Alexander's passing. Do you want to just say a last few words about your dear departed friend?
Well, he was, he was a buddy. He was a comrade. He was a very close friend. And I miss those 7 o'clock in the morning telephone calls. It's just difficult to orient my day without talking to Alex. I said in my piece, I consider him our Voltaire, because he really did puncture the powerful. He didn't stand for pretense, and he was a funny, intelligent, and fiery writer who was a utopian. He believed that things were going to get better, but we have to work our asses off to get us there. And
Jeffrey St. Clair, thanks very much. Talking about California. We've been talking to Jeffrey St. Clair about Alexander Coburn. Thanks a lot and good morning.
Thank you, Cal.